This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents One Little Secret, a novel by Kate Holohan. This book is read by Hilary Huber. To Shauna Maldonado, the Bloomfield Police Department, and all the law enforcement officers who bring to work a deep empathy for the people they protect and dedication to helping folks on their worst days. Prologue. Drowning can happen in 2 inches of water. All the parenting books she'd consumed during her pregnancies had contained that warning, often on the first page of the bath time section. Children could die in a kiddie pool, the sink, the toilet. Life began in an amniotic sac, but it could end in the shallows. Her life could end in these shallows. She clawed at the hands shoving her head beneath the breaking waves. Salt seared her nose. Her eyes burned. Still, she forced herself to scan for a weapon. The dark outline of a rock, the glint of a razor clam, anything besides the foamy veil shrouding her face. Air. God, air. Watery images filled her brain, murky pictures of her kids' childhoods. She saw her oldest, Daddy's clone, with those serious eyes, and her rubber band of a baby, pulled thin by puberty, vibrating with energy. The snapshots strung together like images in a spinning zoetrope. She could see her children aging, growing up without her. The water pulled away. She tried to breathe, but a fetid backwash filled her mouth. Coughing, she pressed her palms to the shifting ground, desperate to push herself upright before the next wave knocked her down. She had to focus. She had to breathe, to fight. Her face slammed back into the froth. A whirling silence filled her ears. The pressure to inhale was more intense than anything she'd ever felt, stronger than the need to push during contractions. And yet, there was a peace, a knowledge that the end would come. It was almost here, if only she'd let go. She pressed harder against the sinking sand, digging in with her knees and fingers. Darkness swept through her brain. She had to fight. She had to breathe. She had to. She. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Day After. The room reminded Gabriella of her daughter's, sans the credit card-sized photos thumbtacked to the white walls, and the irritating poster of a tattooed action star tagged Boyfriend Goals. Like Kayla's space, it had been carved from the attic and thus suffered from a sharp triangular ceiling. A squat dresser huddled beneath a skylight cut into one of the slanted sides. Under the other diagonal, a single mattress rested on a platform so low it resembled a tatami mat. A girl sat atop it, her head lowered over tucked knees, preventing Gabby from seeing more of her than a pair of jean-clad legs pressed to a bulky gray sweatshirt and a curtain of thick black hair. The homeowner, Dinah Collette, had warned that her au pair hadn't wanted to involve the police. But I explained that in America, women don't let men get away with such things. Gabby supposed that Dinah, a former model whose surname changed every few years, didn't let men get away with much. But the rules were different for socialites with established wealth. Truth was, men got away with such things all the time. Gabby's job was to make this time different. She tapped on the door jamb, hoping to announce herself without startling the young woman. According to Dinah, Mariel Cruz had turned 18 in December, 5 months before arriving in the States. Her native language was Tagalog, though Dinah claimed Muriel was fluent in English. Gabby prayed that meant the au pair read American newspapers. Though everyone in the Philippines learned English in school, a typical foreign language curriculum wouldn't cover the vocabulary for sexual assault. She called Mariel's name from the open doorway. The girl lifted her forehead from her thighs. Even with bloodshot eyes and a reddened nose, she was pretty. Her young face punctuated by the full lips that men so often equated with sex, but that Gabby couldn't see without thinking of her pouty 16-year-old. Sitting in her plain room, with her skin scrubbed clean, Mariel appeared even younger than Kayla. Gabby's chest tightened. She reminded herself that the girl before her was technically an adult, even if she could pass for her daughter's classmate. Moreover, it was possible that whatever had happened had been consensual, and that Dinah, disgusted by the idea of some middle-aged neighbor seducing her barely legal au pair, had forced the phone call. Gabby pressed her hand against the open door, pushing it back another inch. "My name is Gabby Watkins. I'm a detective with the East Hampton Police Department. May I come in?" A sniff served as an affirmative response. Gabby stepped into the room, suddenly thankful for her small stature, which enabled her to slip into the cramped space without dominating it. The lack of seating, aside from the bed, meant that Gabby would need to stand for the interview. Plopping on a mattress beside a possible sexual assault victim was even worse than lording over one. "I understand that something happened to you last night. I'd like to help." Mariel pulled at her sweatshirt, attempting to tuck her knees beneath the image of crossed paddles stitched into the fabric.
"Dinah said to call the police. She thinks somebody put a drug in my drink, but I don't know. I don't remember."
The sentences shot out in short gasps, like steam from a rusting heater. Gabby wished that the Collette family had volunteered to go out to breakfast, so that she and Mariel could talk in the kitchen. A glass of water would help the young woman calm down and tell her story fluidly. Details emerged only when a conversation was flowing. And in he said, she said sexual assault cases, the details often decided arrests.
"It's okay if you can't recall everything."
Gabby kept her voice soft, aware that even a normal speaking voice might ricochet against the tight walls. "Let's talk about the party. How did you hear about it?" Mariel stretched the sweatshirt over her kneecaps and rounded her back over her thighs.
"From Fiona O'Rourke. She's an au pair too. She watches a six-year-old in the gray house at the end of the street. She told me that some guys were having a pool party."
"A party where?"
"Pepperidge Lane. I don't know the house number. Fiona picked me up in a lift."
Gabby made another mental note. Fiona's ride-sharing app would have the exact party location.
"I thought they would be Irish students, like Fiona, but the guys were much older."
Mariel released one of her arms from around her covered legs. She picked up a piece of her own black hair.
"A couple were, I don't know how to say, putting buhok. Grease? When the hair begins to lose color?
Graying?" Gabby thought of her own hair, pulled back into a matronly ponytail. If she shook it out, she'd find several strands to confirm what Mariel meant, though not so many that anyone would suggest a dye job. Most of Gabby's fellow 40-year-olds had yet to go full salt and pepper. "The guys were in their 50s, you think? Or older?"
Mariel shuddered. "Late 30s, I think. Maybe 40s. When Fiona introduced me to some of the men, I said we should visit a place with younger people. But she wanted to stay."
Mariel gestured to the room around them.
"I didn't want to be here on my one night off."
In addition to being tiny, Gabby realized Mariel's bedroom was stuffy, despite the air conditioning seeping from the floor vents. Heat camped out in attics. Humidity was already curling the baby hairs not pulled tight by Gabby's ponytail, and she'd been inside only 10 minutes. "How many people were at the party?"
"I don't know, maybe 50. There were many girls like Fiona, college students on summer break. I thought I would stay for a time, and then, if Fiona didn't want to leave, I could take a car with one of the other women.
Gabby stepped closer to Mariel and lowered her voice to a confidential level. But something changed your plans. The girl nodded, dropping her chin lower with each bounce until it was nearly hidden behind her knees.
Two of the men started fighting over a girl. This big black guy was shouting that he would call the cops. He said he'd have people arrested for drinking before they are the right age. I'd had wine.
Mariel's head snapped up, revealing her wide brown eyes.
I'm allowed in the Philippines, and I only took one glass. I know I shouldn't have.
Gabby offered a shy smile. I'm not here about underage drinking. Mariel dropped her chin back to the stretched-out sweatshirt.
I was afraid of trouble, so I went to tell Fiona that I needed to leave. She'd gone inside for the bathroom, and
a sob cut off Mariel's story. The little Gabby could still see of the young woman's face was flushed and strained. Every instinct urged Gabby to hug the girl, filling the maternal role that belonged to a woman 8,000 miles away. But Gabby kept her feet cemented to the floor. She needed to maintain perspective as she listened to Mariel's story for the key words of a crime. Had Mariel said no? Had she been unable to consent? Had she been trapped or forced? So you went into the house to find Fiona, and then what happened?
Mariel's breaths shuddered. I went into the kitchen and saw a couple of men that Fiona had introduced me to. I told them I was searching for her and that a man was outside threatening to phone the police. One of the men ran out to talk to him. Another, I think his name was Mandy, said he'd help me find my friend. He gave me a glass of something, too. It was fruity. I was afraid to drink it and told him I was 18, but he said that the police couldn't enter people's private homes.
A bitter snort sprayed Mariel's top lip with clear mucus. She wiped it with her sweatshirt sleeve, creating a shimmering line atop her lips that shaved even more years from her young face.
That's all I remember before waking up.
Where did you wake up? Mariel covered her mouth with her palm. She squeezed her eyes shut, forcing tears out the sides. Gabby tried again, dropping her voice to a near whisper.
Where did you wake up, Mariel?
In this man's bed.
Mariel's voice dissolved in sobs.
I wasn't wearing clothes, and the guy that was helping me find Fiona was beside me. I don't know what I did. I don't know if we had sex. Maybe I drank too much and fell asleep, and he put me to bed. I told Dinah that I didn't know, and I was sorry. When I explained that I couldn't remember anything, she said I had to talk to the police.
Gabby couldn't stop her hands from curling into fists a second time. Whether or not Mariel had been drugged or fed booze until she blacked out, the man she'd encountered was a predator. He and his friend had lured a bunch of women half their age to a party in hopes of making them drunk and pliable. He'd then identified one of the weaker ones, a newly minted adult, thousands of miles from her family, unfamiliar with alcohol, and abandoned by her friend. I'm sure that you were feeling confused and scared, so I understood if you just got out of there. But can you tell me anything about this man, Mandy? Perhaps what he looked like, and if he said anything to you this morning? Mariel wiped her face with the other sweatshirt sleeve.
He had blonde and brown hair, a mix, and light eyes, maybe green. I was too embarrassed to look close at his face. I asked him what time it was, and he said 7. He invited me to breakfast. I told him that I needed to take the twins to their tennis lessons. He got a car for me.
Mariel pulled at the hair pasted to her cheeks.
If this man raped me, why would he offer me breakfast and pay for my ride home? It doesn't make sense. I must have fallen asleep.
The girl's round eyes begged the authority in the room for reassurance. Part of Gabby wanted to provide it, to assure the still teenager that nothing more horrible had happened than her getting drunk and passing out, and that she didn't need to worry her mother back in the Philippines or go to the hospital for STD screening. But a lie would be worse in the long run. Ignored wounds festered, and a rapist that got away with it would do the same thing to another young girl. The hospital has tests to help us figure out whether or not you were drugged and if you had intercourse with anyone last night. Doctors can also give you medicine to protect you against diseases if the sex was unprotected. Mariel's pleading stare morphed to panic.
I don't have health insurance here. I earn $200 a week. I can't afford to see doctors.
The statement grabbed Gabby's tense insides and twisted. The predator really had picked a prime candidate, choosing a young woman who would be more concerned about the cost of treatment than catching her attacker. There are victims' funds that will reimburse you, eventually. Mariel's eyes filled with fresh tears.
Do the tests hurt?
The question made Gabby's own eyes sting. She tilted her head to the ceiling, forcing her emotions back into her stomach. As she did, her phone began buzzing. Gabby removed her cell, intending to decline the call. Jason DeMarco's name dominated the screen. Detective DeMarco would have been handling Gabby's rape report had he not been pulled away minutes earlier on a possible assault. Gabby, who'd spent most of the night investigating a DUI that had totaled an SUV and a telephone pole, had been the only other detective on call. Fortunately for Mariel, since DeMarco wasn't known for his sensitivity or tact. Perhaps he'd already resolved his case and was offering relief. Gabby pocketed the phone and turned her attention back to Mariel's pinched face. The tests are invasive, unfortunately. She slowed her East Coast speech to the speed of a Texas drawl, aware that she'd come to the part of the interview involving more technical vocabulary. The doctors will look for fibers, like pieces of hair or carpet, and they will give you an internal physical examination, similar to what happens at a gynecologist. Many people find the tests upsetting to endure after an attack, though they can clear up what happened last night, if you had sexual intercourse with anyone, and if there are any sedatives or other strange chemicals in your system. Mariel's jaw dropped with an unspoken question. A shy knock snapped it closed. Gabby glanced over her shoulder to see Dinah in the doorway, a sparkling glass of water in one hand and an aspirin in her outstretched palm. Gabby swallowed her annoyance at the second break in her momentum. For all intents and purposes, Dinah was as close to a mom as Mariel had in the country. If the young woman decided to go ahead with the tests, she'd need someone. Gabby cleared her throat before continuing. Unfortunately, the drugs used in these kind of assaults are designed to move through the body quickly. The longer you wait to visit the hospital, the less likely they are to show up on any exams. Dinah nodded as she approached, as though she knew all about forensic sexual exams. She sat beside Mariel, placed the aspirin in her charge's hand, and then draped her arm over the girl's shoulder.
I'm so sorry. What happened was not your fault, okay? This man is a rapist. You're being so brave to hold him responsible. He can't do this to you.
Mariel hung her head, not agreeing with Dinah so much as surrendering to her. As much as Gabby wanted to put Mariel's attacker behind bars, the last thing an assaulted woman needed was to feel stripped of the little agency she had left. Gabby dropped into a crouched position so she could look into Mariel's lowered eyes.
It's your decision, Mariel. Only you can make it, and no one will be angry with you, no matter what you choose. If you decide to go through with it and give us evidence, though, I will do everything in my power to make sure this man is punished for what he did to you and prevented from ever doing it again.
Mariel met Gabby's intense stare. Though she didn't say anything, Gabby saw a spark of fight. The girl slipped her legs from inside her sweatshirt and pushed herself to a standing position. Dinah immediately shot up, holding her au pair's arm.
I'll drive you, Dinah offered. I can do that, right?
Gabby's pocket buzzed. That would be good. I'll let the hospital know you're both coming. She withdrew the phone as though she intended to call ahead and not check her caller ID. DeMarco's number was on screen again. Gabby reaffirmed the name of the local medical center with Dinah and promised to alert them to Mariel's impending arrival. Her pocket continued vibrating as she said her stoic goodbyes. Gabby waited until she'd hit the first staircase landing to answer. Hello, Jason?
Sergeant.
Gabby bristled. Since her promotion, her passed-over male colleagues had taken to using her title instead of her first name. She still wasn't sure whether they intended respect or mockery. When she'd gotten the job 2 months prior, there'd been grumbling about the chief trying to diversify the ranks, as though her fawn brown face and female parts had counted more than her 10 years on the force, the past 3 with the detective title.
What's going on? I've been with a sexual assault victim. Why all the calls?
We need you at the beach.
Gabby picked up her speed across the landing. The assault call?
Patrolman Kelly used the 10 code and a new dispatcher read it wrong. A woman is dead. The coroner's office will confirm, but it's looking like she was drowned.
Gabby gripped the handrail. The Hamptons didn't get many murders, and she liked it that way. She'd applied for the job on Long Island South Fork, in part because of the low rate of violent crime. Becoming a police officer had been about keeping people safe and supporting her family, not hunting armed killers. Murders should really go to the county. The call this morning is looking like a drugged date rape, and the way this guy selected his victim, I'm guessing it's not his first time. A homicide is better equipped to handle the forensics.
The woman's bathing suit was half torn off. The Suffolk Crime Lab folks are here gathering evidence. But if this started as a sexual assault, you have the most experience. Also, the Vic's friend is here. She's in a state.
DeMarco's repeated redials suddenly made sense. Handling females in a state was Gabby's unofficial job description. Since making detective, she'd been assigned nearly all the sex crimes and weeping women on the assumption that such assaults were more suited to her gender. And the realization from her peers that many of the cases devolved into a mess of allegations and recriminations that prosecutors wouldn't touch. The work was draining, and the rewards often never materialized. But somebody had to try. And as the only female detective, she was that somebody. A surge of adrenaline chased away the prickles of fatigue in Gabby's legs. Her heels pounded down the steps. Send the address, detective. I'm on my way.
Chapter 2. The Day of.
Jenny had already lost her daughter. She'd been trailing Allie, keeping tabs on the head of Corkscrew Curls bobbing through the clogged Manhattan sidewalk at a speed intended to ditch her mother. A moment earlier, her 12-year-old had been feet in front of her. But Allie had disappeared beyond the mosh pit of teenage boys, slapping greetings and simultaneously blocking Jenny's route to the corner. Do you see Allie? Jenny reached for Lewis, as she always did when worried, despite him having caused the problem in the first place.
Allie wouldn't have been weaving through the waiting families if Lewis hadn't panicked them all about missing drop-off because of Jenny needing a few extra minutes to put on her face. Lewis grasped her hand, using his free one to shield his eyes from the already blaring sun.
I think she found Chloe. See the pale blonde? That looks like Allie hugging her.
Jenny pushed her sunglasses to the top of her head, removing the amber filter that had blended Chloe's platinum mane with all the darker blonde ponytails. She squinted at a group in identical camp shirts at the end of Lewis's outstretched finger. Allie's auburn spirals peeked out from behind Chloe's broad shoulders. Their neighbor's daughter had inherited her mother's near albino coloring and her father's height, enabling her to always stand out in a crowd. Jenny wondered if Chloe would ultimately find that as a mixed blessing as she did. The sea of boys began to part in front of her. Jenny felt their eyes on her revealed face. Whispers fizzed on both sides of her, building in strength like a wave.
Is that? I think so. Dude, do you have a ball?
Snickering.
Dude, do you have a Sports Illustrated?
Had she been alone, Jenny wouldn't have minded giving an autograph, but this morning needed to be about bidding goodbye to her baby for 7 weeks, not her second career or her husband's feelings about it.
Where's your wedding ring?
Jenny yanked her hand from Lewis's grip and examined her long brown fingers as though their bareness surprised her. Donning all those carrots to send her daughter into the Maine wilderness, to a camp with the feminist empowerment motto, growing strong girls no less, had seemed unnecessary, if not inappropriate. In a lockbox, in the trunk. She hadn't been wearing the Eternity Band much in the past few weeks, though for their trip she'd packed it inside a portable jewelry safe for the inevitable night when someone, likely Rachel, decreed they should all go out for a fancy dinner. Jenny donned her much-practiced, "Everything is all right," smile, hoping to stave off a scolding about the dangers of leaving expensive, easily transported items in a garage manned by key-wielding valets. In hindsight, the decision not to wear it didn't seem very logical. Disapproval flickered in her husband's blue eyes, a gas flame turned on only to be promptly shut off. Like her, Lewis wanted their daughter's send-off to be negativity-free. They both shared the unspoken understanding that all potentially incendiary dialogues should wait until after Allie was on one of the buses idling on the side of the street. Still, what one person viewed as playing with fire, the other might consider a statement of mere fact. Lewis reclaimed her hand, apparently agreeing that the ring discussion could wait a few hours, or perhaps be avoided completely. The tense energy wafting from him didn't mean he'd let the subject go, but it didn't mean he was holding on to it either. In 18 years together, Jenny had never known her husband to give off a particularly relaxed vibe. When she'd first met him in medical school, she'd thought of a copper cable, in part because of the way the autumn sun had set his red hair ablaze, but mostly because of his presence. His body seemed formed by the twisting together of muscle and sinew, each internal fiber conducting its own heat and electricity. Jenny pulled Lewis through the path made by the staring boys. As soon as they cleared the group, he tugged back on her palm.
I don't think she wants us hovering, teenage girls.
Her husband might as well have pointed out the color of the sky. Ben and Rachel had apparently decided it was fine to leave Chloe by herself before boarding the bus. Of course, Allie would want to demonstrate the same level of independence, especially given the presence of older boys destined for the brother camp. But Allie was only 12, and Jenny wasn't about to let her pretend to be more mature the morning before spending a summer away from home.
Seeing her daughter giving the boys sly glances as Chloe whispered, Jenny wanted to grab Allie and transport them both back to a time before puberty and secrets. Sometimes Jenny wished she could rewind a full 5 years to when she'd still been home with an elementary schooler, working just 2 days a week in a sports medicine clinic and once a month or less commenting on injuries for ESPN. At that time, Lewis had still been a trauma fellow, laboring under 80-hour hospital shifts, so she'd had Allie to herself most of the week. Her daughter had loved and admired her then. Jenny mentally scolded herself for being so negative. She and Allie had been close until recently. If not friends, certainly more than simply a mom and daughter who loved each other. Until 6 months ago, Jenny would have said that Allie genuinely liked hanging out with her. Evidently, turning 12 and a half flipped some internal teenage switch, triggering the raging bitch years her mother had warned her about. Jenny pulled from Lewis's hold. "She'll have 7 weeks without me. She can deal with another hour of my existence." Lewis followed Jenny's lead, remaining a step behind, so it would be apparent that Mom had demanded the embarrassing reunion. Her husband wouldn't dare do anything to risk his favored status with Allie. Somehow, he'd remained insulated from the hormonal backdraft that blasted Jenny each time she tried to talk to their daughter. Daddy was still given pecks on the cheeks and promises to return home before curfew. Allie even shared the occasional frustration with him, like her difficulty with one crush that had thought her too different-looking, aka ethnic. "Allie!" Jenny called to her, as though seeing her daughter for the first time since arriving. If Allie had been pretending to be unchaperoned, she could save face by claiming that her parents had been parking the car. Allie looked over at them and then rolled her eyes toward her best friend. Chloe tossed her near-white mane in agreement, a filly swatting a fly. "So, are you two all ready for 7 weeks?" Jenny smiled, despite her daughter's irritated expression. "I don't know what I'm going to do without you both hanging in the kitchen all the time. The house will feel so lonely." Allie tilted her head to emphasize her incredulous stare. "I'm sure you'll manage." Jenny reached for her daughter's hand. "But I'll miss you." Allie sidestepped the attempt at physical contact. She looked over Jenny's shoulder to Lewis. "Dad, make sure Mom doesn't have too much time alone." The condescension couldn't have been clearer. "Dad, Mom is complaining about something again. You fix it. I can't be expected to deal with her." Jenny didn't consider herself a whiner. She supposed she could be critical sometimes, especially when she felt Lewis had been getting away with too much. But all things considered, Jenny thought herself rather adept at keeping her problems to herself. Lewis landed a loud smacking kiss against Jenny's cheek. "Don't worry, sweetheart. I'll take care of your mother." Allie's nose wrinkled in disgust. "Camp Nova!" A growling female voice blasted through a bullhorn. "If you are in Camp Nova, form a line along that wall. We will be boarding in a couple minutes." The chatter on the sidewalk swelled into a chorus of goodbyes. Chloe gestured with her head to Allie and started toward the brick side of the building. Allie held back for a moment, allowing Lewis to pull her into both of them for a final embrace. Jenny felt Allie bristle against her chest.
"Chloe, wait, Chloe!"
Ben's bark broke through the din. Their neighbor jogged from around the corner, his wide shoulders and 6'5" frame overshadowing the other dads. The crowd parted for him, as it had for Jenny. He ran through the space and tackled his daughter in a bear hug. Like Allie, Chloe seemed to suffer through the embrace. She didn't wrap her arms around her father's chest or offer any reassuring pats. When he released her, Ben looked about as disappointed as Jenny felt.
"Sorry, saying goodbye to your brother took a little longer than expected."
Ben rubbed the back of his neck.
We love you, kiddo, and we're going to miss you. But I know you're going to have a great time.
Chloe glanced around her father's broad sides. Rachel's heels clapped up the sidewalk. Had it not been for the sound, Jenny might have mistaken the woman in the crowd for one of the teens. Her slight, jean-clad figure blended in with the other narrow-hipped girls. Before she reached all of them, Rachel opened her arms toward her daughter. Chloe went running, shattering all of Jenny's gender and age-related justifications for Allie's attitude. If near 13-year-old girls hated their mothers, then why was Chloe hugging hers like she might forego camp altogether if Rachel asked that she stay? Why the tears in both their eyes? Why was Chloe lingering by her female parent while Allie had already staked out a spot in the boarding line? The loving sight sickened Jenny with jealousy and self-doubt. She really tried to be a good mother, but clearly she was doing something wrong. Save perhaps for the 3 weeks of March Madness, Rachel worked longer hours at her law firm than Jenny did in the television studios. Jenny attended more school events than Rachel. Jenny was the parent who had taught Allie to read and write and had learned the new Common Core math to help with homework. Yet her only child despised her. Jenny wrested her attention from the knife-twisting scene. I guess we should go. Lewis squeezed her to his side and stepped toward the line.
We'll grab one more hug.
Allie leaned against the building with a wide stance, saving space for her best friend. As they approached her, Ben bounded over to them, seemingly happy to focus on something besides the tender mother-daughter moment from which he'd been excluded. Jenny pulled from Lewis to accept a hello hug. Her neighbor's height forced her to look up as he bent down to brush his face against the side of hers, bringing his lips within grazing distance of her cheekbone. It was the American version of the French greeting kiss, made more intimate by the tilted heads. Lewis, in turn, received a masculine nod of acknowledgement. Ben gave Allie a neighborly wave. Her daughter stared at Chloe's dad like he'd intruded on a sleepover party, eyes wide with revulsion. Jenny cleared her throat to communicate her disapproval at the gawking. It was one thing for Allie to be rude to her. Parents had to accept a certain amount of boundary testing. But she couldn't let her kid insult another helicoptering adult just because Allie wanted to pretend to be a big girl. Say hi to Ben, Allie. Allie glared at her. Hi, Mr. Hansen. She folded her arms across her chest. Mom, your makeup is melting. Jenny swiped at the corner of her nose. Her finger picked up a brownish-yellow glaze from the foundation she'd layered on earlier. The amount of cover-up required to hide the purplish blur beneath her left eye had necessitated heavy makeup. She faced Lewis. Am I all right? Her husband's smile thinned as he gave her skin a clinical once-over.
Yeah, you're good.
He chuckled.
Paparazzi prepared.
Allie snorted. Thankfully, someone will keep an eye on her. The exchange didn't strike Jenny as amusing, despite Lewis's laughter. Humor, she knew, was often a mask for frustration. Her husband had never been comfortable with her move from orthopedist to ESPN injury analyst to full-time CBS sports commentator. He often grumbled that she was known in town as the attractive black woman from TV, rather than his preferred titles of Mrs. Murray or Allie's mom. And he'd railed in the past about her minor celebrity, threatening to make them all tabloid fodder. Before Jenny could join in the laughter at her own expense, Rachel came up, arm in arm with her adoring child. She released Chloe into the line and then stood beside Ben. Rachel's head didn't quite reach his shoulder. The woman with the megaphone announced for a second time that the campers should line up and head toward their labeled buses. Chloe and Allie began shuffling forward.
Jenny waved to the girls, even though she knew from her daughter's turned head that her goodbye would go unacknowledged. They all watched in silence as the kids stepped onto the bus, turning back only after Ben had confirmed from his higher vantage point that their children were seated. "Are you two heading out now?" Rachel sniffled. Jenny didn't know whether she really cared about the answer or simply wanted to distract herself from the bus taking away her daughter. Lewis shrugged.
Might as well beat Friday traffic.
Rachel's tongue clicked against her teeth. I wouldn't rush. Susan and Nadal still have to drop Jonah at his camp, and I am guessing that will take a bit. She lowered her voice. He had an issue this morning.
Ben cleared his throat.
It wasn't that bad.
Rachel pulled her chin to her neck. You had to carry him out of the crowd, hun. You said he was hitting himself. She turned to Jenny. I was saying goodbye to Will, so I didn't see the whole thing. But I gather it was pretty awful. When I got there, Jonah was rocking back and forth beside a building.
Ben shot Rachel a disapproving glance. Lewis scratched his forehead. It was his doctor move, one Jenny had seen many times during their emergency room residencies. When thinking about medicine, Lewis rubbed his frontal lobe, as if massaging his differential diagnosis into the language center of his brain.
They should really try him on risperidone. It works wonders with self-harm in autistic kids.
Ben tilted his head in Jenny's direction, seeking a second opinion. She'd heard that the drug could make kids sluggish, but she wasn't in a position to comment. Her medical license was only for maintaining the MD in her television moniker and writing personal prescriptions. Moreover, she didn't want to pontificate about either of her new neighbor's twins. Though she knew Jonah's diagnosis, Susan had never discussed it with her in detail. In fact, their relationship had yet to progress much past polite chatter about school functions. Jenny assumed she and Lewis had been invited to go in on the Hamptons' house simply because any place on the water would have been prohibitively expensive for two couples alone. Rachel tossed a hand in the air. Maybe they don't like the drug's side effects. Lewis shot Rachel the same exasperated look that Jenny gave her fellow anchors when they tried to diagnose Achilles injuries from instant replays.
Or maybe, he said, they're having difficulty finding a doctor willing to prescribe it. Doctors are gun-shy when it comes to autism. The anti-vaxxers made us all afraid of some lawyer taking us to court for developmental delays.
Rachel returned Lewis's irritated expression. As a personal injury attorney, Rachel was more likely than not to be some lawyer.
Doctors don't need to fear providing drugs that are FDA approved to treat particular diagnoses. If the physician has the problem correctly pegged, then he's in the clear, unless he's been specifically alerted to another ailment that would result in a complication.
Jenny felt Lewis's energy change beside her, his vibrations intensifying like a tuning fork struck twice.
Well, we should get on the road.
He gave a curt wave and whirled in the opposite direction, announcing his aggravation with the conversation. Jenny offered what she hoped was an apologetic smile.
See you at the beach.
Lewis echoed her statement over his shoulder.
See you.
Jenny caught up to him as he trailed off, grumbling the last word under his breath. To Jenny, it didn't sound like beach.
Chapter 3. The Day Of. Do I have the right address? The incredulity in her husband's tone startled Susan awake. She drifted off, watching the repetitive green blur outside the passenger window, exhausted and emotionally drained from the morning. The foliage outside had since ceased moving, but her view still seemed out of focus, a shaking Polaroid yet to reveal a real image. All she could see clearly was Jonah,
sprawled on the dirty sidewalk, his flailing legs enforcing a circle of personal space, and the gawking onlookers who had surrounded the two of them, all staring as though her son had been some kind of breakdancing street performer and not a child breaking down. Susan blamed herself for Jonah's flare-up. She should have known that the combination of the humid morning, dense crowd, and seeing his brother taking off with his new best friend, Will, would prove too much for her hypersensitive 9-year-old. But she'd convinced herself that witnessing Jamal's excited departure would ease Jonah's anxiety about his own week-long stay at camp. As a result, Jonah had displayed the worst of his symptoms in front of their neighbor's boy and countless other families, many from their new town. "Is this it, honey?" Nadal leaned over to inspect the screen on the SUV's console and the waving red flag announcing they'd reached their destination. Susan shifted her fuzzy attention to the windshield. A grayed cedar structure loomed at the end of the clamshell drive. Her stomach dropped. No, this can't be it. She called up the address in her text message history and compared it to the number on the mailbox at the property's edge. It matched, though it shouldn't have. The timber-clad salt box before her, with its long rectangular sides and slanted roof, was not a luxury farmhouse. It was a barn. A plain, simple, $3,000 per night barn. She imagined her new friend's reactions to the building in front of them. Ben would be a good sport, as always, and she didn't know Jenny and Lewis well enough for them to be anything but polite. Whether or not anyone said anything explicit, though, they'd all be thinking the same thought, pulling up her husband's right eyebrow. Why on earth did she book us here for a fortune?
Location is everything, right?
Nadal tried to cover his quizzical expression with a smile. The cliché had been their real estate agent's refrain when they'd been searching for houses 10 months earlier. The woman had taken her and Nadal through a series of tiny tutors on lots measured in square feet, each listed in the same price range as multi-acre estates back home. "This isn't Washington State, sweetheart," the realtor had said when Susan had balked at the listings. "This is Westchester. You're 16 miles from Manhattan on a commuter train line. Basically, you're moving to Mecca." The agent had said that last part, smirking at Nadal, as though her analogy had contained particular relevance for the almond-colored man considering kitchen appliances. Susan had informed her that Boston-born and bred Nadal believed Mecca was where the Sox played. "Living 20 minutes from Yankee Stadium doesn't have the same attraction," she'd said. Quip notwithstanding, they'd purchased one of those overpriced homes in the right locale. And, Susan reminded herself, so had all their new neighbors. Perhaps Nadal was right. The barn before her was nestled in the Amagansett Dunes with direct access to the Atlantic Ocean. Surely the others would know not to expect much curb appeal, exorbitant cost aside. Wouldn't they? Nadal turned left and let the car roll toward the forest marking the edge of the property and the inverted L-shaped driveway. Shells rattled beneath the chassis until the vehicle finally pulled parallel to a white gate leading, Susan supposed, to the backyard. She exited and squinted at the structure, hoping that the late afternoon sunlight would illuminate some redeeming feature. The house appeared just as dour as it had through the windshield, however. Rain had weathered the siding to a drizzly gray. The windows were small, squinty insect eyes atop a gaping barn door mouth. The smallest panes, tucked beneath the ski-slope roof, appeared to wink at them. From the front, the home hardly looked large enough to accommodate three couples. "It looked so much bigger on the website, didn't it?" A beep answered. Nadal disappeared beneath the SUV's rising hatch. He grunted from the weight of something that Susan knew couldn't be their suitcase.
Her husband prided himself on his fitness regimen, weights multiple times a week, cardio on weekends. He woke at 5 daily for the gym, a fact that had once impressed her, though lately had made her resentful. She couldn't squeeze in regular workouts between caring for the twins and the house. Her CEO husband was becoming even more handsome and wealthy, while she was letting herself go.
It has 3 bedrooms, 3 baths, an outdoor shower, a pool, and is on the beach in the Hamptons, honey.
Nadal emerged, a vein pulsing in his left bicep from carrying the massive cardboard boxes cradled in his arms.
If it were any larger, it would have only been available for the full summer and cost the down payment on our house.
He braced the wine cases against his chest and headed toward the door. Don't worry, he called behind him. Everyone knew what they were getting into. A shrill ring emanated from Nadal's pocket. Her husband's lips parted. For a moment, it seemed he would try to shift the weight onto one arm to answer the phone, an act almost as insane as leaving a wife with a screaming child to answer an office call, as he'd done that morning.
Honey, I know work is crazy right now. Susan forced a lightness into her voice so that Nadal wouldn't realize how angry she still was about his earlier disappearance. But let's try to be present this week. It took a while for me to plan this, and it's important for our family to make some real friends in the area. Jonah needs people that will look out for him like we had back home, and we have to foster that. He's not Jamal.
Nor, Susan thought, was she. Though both her boys were tall, dark, and handsome, like their father, only their neurotypical son had inherited Nadal's attractive personality. Jamal, like her husband, came across as smart and affable, the kind of person others welcomed onto their team and into their homes. Susan, like Jonah, was shyer, or at least she'd become that way since her recent fiasco. To make friends, she had to plan vacations for the neighborhood. Nadal readjusted the weight in his arms.
I know, honey.
The stress on the nickname turned it sour.
And I'm sorry, again. Something came up right before we left, and I still...
You're the CEO of a tech startup. Something always comes up.
Susan felt the scowl parting her lips. She forced a tight smile. It would mean a lot.
I already promised, and I mean it.
Nadal returned her smile like a tennis volley.
I won't let anything spoil this week.
He started toward the house. Susan retrieved their duffel from the trunk. She slung the bag over her shoulder and then stretched to shut the hatch. The overhead motion released the acrid odor in her armpits. Stress sweat stunk worse than regular perspiration. Maybe, she thought, she could freshen up before the others arrived, apply some makeup, slip into a sundress. At the very least, she could assess whether or not the barn's interior measured up to the online photos. If it didn't, she couldn't back out of the rental, but she could preempt complaints with her own. Susan hurried toward her husband as he closed in on the entrance. I'll get the door. Nadal wouldn't wait. He raised a knee and shifted the liquor boxes onto his left side, freeing his right arm to retract the sliding panel mounted on a thick overhead track. Behind the barn door stood another, though this one was glass, coated with a dark film to cloud the view inside. A round electronic keypad had been bolted above the handle. Susan jostled in front of her husband to deal with the lock. As she touched the black screen, numbers appeared. She tapped in the 4-digit code, an easy-to-recall 1492, the same year Columbus sailed the ocean blue. A green light flashed around the high-tech device, followed by a welcoming tone and a whirring noise, like an electric can opener. A rattling overwhelmed the sound of the lock. Susan turned to see a familiar cherry Range Rover crunching down the driveway. She pressed the door handle. Showering before saying her hellos was out of the question. Still, perhaps she could glimpse the inside before the Murrays.
Hey, Hold the door for us?
Jenny called as she climbed out of the Range Rover. I forgot the code you emailed. I've no head for numbers.
Susan pushed back the tinted glass in front of her. A glance inside the house revealed only a narrow hallway and the glow of a distant window. The online photos had shown a ton of natural light. The clink of bottles called her attention back to the threshold. She turned to see the wine cases at Nadal's feet and his arms around Jenny as they said hello.
How was the ride?
He asked. Can't complain. Jenny separated from Nadal and extended her toned arms toward Susan. The three-hour-plus car ride had done nothing to dull Jenny's cover girl appearance. She wore a flowing, off-shoulder shirt that displayed her pronounced clavicle and raw linen shorts revealing her long, chiseled legs. Her makeup, which Susan could tell included foundation from the uniformity of her caramel skin color, was flawless beneath her Jackie O sunglasses. If a paparazzo jumped out of the bushes to ask whether the Giants' injured running back would play next season, Jenny would be ready. Susan's discomfort deepened at her own haggard appearance. She forced a smile and leaned into the waiting hug.
Sorry, I'm a bit sweaty from the ride up.
Jenny grinned. Who isn't?
You,
Susan thought. Unless, of course, Jenny's natural BO smelled of gardenias. Susan half suspected that it did. Jenny Murray was the Mary Poppins of neighborhood moms. She was TV beautiful, with a body like sculpted glass, and an encyclopedic knowledge of both the human body and sports. To boot, she was painstakingly pleasant. Not once in the 10 months Susan had lived next door to her had she ever seen Jenny evidently stressed. She'd never heard her snipe at her spouse in the backyard, snap at her daughter, or betray a hint of sarcasm in her tone, let alone raise her voice as Susan did, too often. Practically perfect in every way.
You look great. Susan brushed the sleeve covering Jenny's bicep. I love this blouse.
Jenny winced. The reaction made Susan feel catty for the compliment, as though she'd intended to shame her neighbor for being too done up in a casual setting. Susan hoped that hadn't been her motivation, though she couldn't be sure. Insecurity, with a pinch of marital anxiety,